You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody. You are officially on the couch here with Dr. Michelle, and today we have a really great guest. You're going to love reading the book that he just co-authored as well, and you're going to learn a lot about how to heal from trauma. And I think we've all had trauma in our lives to a certain extent, and we're going to find out about different traumas as well, and they're all relevant and important. Well, my special guest today is Michael Baldwin, and there he is. Hey, Michael, welcome to the couch.
Hey, Michelle, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. You, of course, co-authored your latest book. It's called Every Memory Deserves Respect, EMDR, Proven Trauma Therapy with the Power to Heal. And what a powerful title. I love that. Every Memory, oh boy, does it ever.
Well, there's a reason for it. I'll tell you if you want to know.
I would love to know. Yes.
Well, the therapy acronym stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing, which no one will ever remember. I thought if I could give it a title that had a set of words that were in context to the memory-based therapy, I'd give people a much bigger chance of being able to remember EMDR. So Every Memory Deserves Respect.
Beautiful.
EMDR, same acronym, yes, but a set of words that are in context for a memory-based therapy that, you know, you kind of can't forget them.
Sure, exactly. Beautifully said. That makes a lot of sense. And that's how most people say, what about EMDR? You know, you're right. They don't get that right away.
But or DRM or, you know, ERM.
Right. Let's talk about you. You're an accomplished leader in the communication industry. More than 40 years of award-winning work in advertising. What, did you start when you were like, what, 10 or something? I don't know. You are the founder and the principal of the branding and communication for Michael Baldwin Incorporated. Of course, you're in New York. Thank you for joining us. And I love your compelling story because you are a trauma survivor. Some of the stuff you've been through, my gosh. I mean, if you don't mind, would love to hear more, and I want you to share that with some of the listeners and viewers here, but you have been actively involved in the process of recovery for a very long time. You tried different methodologies, different orientations, and just kind of didn't do it. So today we're going to talk about your book, and you co-authored, by the way, with therapist Deborah Korn, and she is an EMDR specialist, right?
She is, and she's a renowned therapist and an incredible, unbelievable therapist, clinician, and person.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that.
Who I didn't know from Adam when I started this project.
Yeah. Oh, that's something. That's really cool. So the universe brought you together.
Exactly. You
know, that's the way it works, right? So let's go back to the beginning before you had EMDR therapy. And it looked like you had the world on a string. Looked like everything was rocking for you. High-powered job. Prestigious New York City agency. You had the two-story penthouse. Come on, Upper East Side. But beneath all that, you were really having some unresolved childhood trauma. And it does last. And those neural patterns are hardwired. And those thoughts and traumas that fire together, wire together. And they can stay with us all of our lives unless we work on it. So can you talk a little bit about your early trauma and then your journey of how you went about healing yourself?
Yeah, if I had to sum it up, I would say that if you can imagine 0 to 5, a person who pretty much had no one to support, no one to turn to, no one to protect and defend. So I was pretty much unsupported, unloved, insecure, and a pretty strong conviction of being worthless and unlovable. And, you know, at face value, sort of like my adult life, I was in a very well-off family and all the trappings of a well-off family that you would expect.
Right.
But I looked like a refugee from a war-torn country. I remember showing a picture of me when I was about, well, let's see, can I show it to you?
Sure.
When I was about two.
Oh my God, yeah, I want to see this. Oh my God, look at how darling. Look at that little soul.
Yeah, as a
Oh.
2 year old, and you know, you can't really see it
Yeah,
that well,
sure. No,
but
but I can see that. Oh, look
when
at him.
Dr. Magnavita, who was my EMDR therapist, and to
Yeah.
clarify for your audience, my therapist was not my co-author.
Okay.
That was Debbie Korn is my co-author. Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita was my therapist. He
Mm-hmm.
took one look at that picture and he said, "This, you know, this is a clue that the blank stare of a neglected child." So for
Right.
me, willful neglect on the part of both of my parents, and I, you know, the symptoms that I dealt with as an adult for decades were phobias that I wasn't even aware
Oh,
I had them
yeah.
or what they were.
Yeah.
I had two particular nightmares that plagued me for over 30 years, that they were as intense the first time I had them as the most recent time I had them. I couldn't use a public restroom. I was afraid of heights. Any suggestion or proximity of any kind of intimacy with a woman was totally panic
Oh,
inducing.
God.
And
Yeah.
the weird thing about all this is I just thought this was how I was. And, you
Well,
know,
yeah.
again, for the benefit of your listeners, you know, it's not like I wasn't trying. I spent about 22 years over the course of 22 years seeing seven different therapists in different parts of the country, CBT therapy, talk therapy, intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy,
Yep.
and none of them really offered any sustained or substantive
Right.
relief for me. And
Right.
none of them mentioned the word trauma,
Right.
and
Oh
none of
my
them were
God.
EMDR therapists.
Right. Right.
So, fast forwarding to more of the adult symptoms, you know, serious alcohol abuse, combination of Vicodin with alcohol as a kind of a
Oh.
numbing escape.
Sure.
And I became pretty much in defense or to mitigate this core belief of
Sure.
being worthless, I became a status and achievement junkie. So
You
I was a
sure?
24/7 workaholic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just lived kind of a detached, sort of numb kind of existence, where at the same time, at the outside, creating this facade, this grandiosity facade of the
Yeah,
job that I had, the
sure.
career that I had, where I
Sure.
lived, et cetera.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty striking contrast about what was really going on. And the other interesting thing for me was I was unaware of at least two, if not more so, of the more traumatic childhood events. Had no idea about them from a conscious standpoint.
Right,
That
right.
was all
Oh.
uncovered in through EMDR therapy.
Wow, that's amazing to me because you and I just before the interview were talking about, I ask you about hypnotherapy and I work with that and I work with people and some things are uncovered, but what's interesting is, people fabricate when they're in the alpha or theta state wave, brainwave. So, and that's what's going on with hypnotherapy. But EMDR actually brought that stuff out, which is so interesting
Yeah.
to me.
Yep.
You knew about some of the trauma, of course. You had what are called flashbulb memories, I guess, of traumatic moments or feelings and things, which
For
you
me,
didn't
it was
know the depth.
correct. So I never made a connection between my conscious, you know, the adult symptoms I was having and the childhood traumatic events in my past. Never made that connection. And as I said earlier, none of the seven therapists I saw, and you know, it's not like they were bad
Yeah.
therapists,
No.
but trauma was never a part of the conversation. So that wasn't brought to my attention. I never thought of myself as a trauma victim or a
Yeah.
trauma survivor or anything. Trauma was just, I was like most people, I assume, or a lot of people listening right now, who assume that trauma means you were in combat, you survived a natural
Oh, right.
disaster,
Right,
you're
right.
held up at gunpoint. They don't understand that trauma is a part of life. And you know, getting divorced or losing a parent or being fired or being bullied, particularly things like bullying, when the events happen during childhood, your worldview is so narrow and your world is so small that things are amplified exponentially. And as you mentioned earlier,
Yeah,
they
yeah.
stay there locked in your nervous system
Sure.
unless and until you are able to deal with them. Hopefully, you know, from my point of view, it was EMDR therapy.
No, that's beautiful. So, how did you become introduced to EMDR? How did this come about?
So the break, the nadir for me, the low point was when I was laid off from the advertising agency I was working with in New York,
right,
where I wanted to work my entire advertising career. So it was like right. the Mount Olympus for me.
Yeah.
I finally got there. And when I was laid off, which was not an uncommon phenomenon in advertising, completely went off a cliff.
Yeah.
Wheels came off,
yeah.
lost my high-powered, high-status job,
right.
you know, sold my apartment. I was all of a sudden, you know, making really bad financial decisions. And at really kind of the low point, my sister said, you know, she knew of a therapist, Dr. Jeffrey Magnavita in Glastonbury, Connecticut,
nice.
Who was 110 miles away from me. I lived in Manhattan. And she said, you know, what difference does that make? Are you serious or not? And that's
wow.
how I found out about him. We started EMDR therapy the very first time I saw him.
It sounds like you had an awesome sister.
Yeah, I did. I think a lifesaver, including, yes. and so was he.
Oh, that's wonderful. Oh,
absolutely.
That's beautiful. So you went to see this therapist. And so how did that roll out? He was explaining to you the concept of EMDR?
Well, you know, it's funny how I expressed this notion or this idea when I walked into his office.
Yeah.
I was in such a state, low point.
Yeah.
It was as if, I like to say, I was like emotionally crowning, you know, where, you know, the baby is coming. Everybody here, I can see the head. It's coming.
Right.
It's like, I think he took one look at me and could see that I was right at the edge. And so we started with the EMDR therapy the very first time I saw him. And I remember dealing primarily, you know, initially with a lot of the preverbal and very young childhood neglect and the longing and the loneliness and the fear and anxiety. And it was just emotionally just coming out in just like waves. It was like punching a hole in a dam and just watching these emotions come out really emotionally, convulsively. And I remember when I was driving back to New York after the first time I saw him and having this unbelievably profound sense of relief.
Oh my God. That's amazing.
I
love that. And that was the first time.
That was the first time. I saw him for over 2 years. And it was pretty much like that. You know, every time I saw him, he's fluent in, you know, IFS and all forms. He speaks all psychiatric languages. And EMDR was a part of pretty much every session we had.
Oh, can we talk a little bit about EMDR and how that works? And so people can kind of understand, you know, the mechanism of the mind body connection, the eye movement connection.
So just one little setting the stage thing. The reason why I wanted to write this book is because I was so ignorant about trauma and I was completely unaware of EMDR therapy. I figured because it saved my life, I figured if I could create a book that was completely accessible to the layperson, other people could find out, could have trauma decoded for them and find out about EMDR therapy, which according to my co-author is the most efficient and effective treatment for PTSD and trauma that she practices. So as I said earlier, it stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. But EMDR therapy is a memory-based therapy. And the premise of EMDR therapy is that unprocessed traumatic memories are the root cause of virtually every behavioral health symptom there is.
Yep.
So unprocessed traumatic memories, unprocessed traumatic experiences are the root cause of pretty much every behavioral health. And that means including physiological.
Yeah.
Irritable bowel syndrome or, you know, back problems or muscle issues or, you know, gastric issues, you name it, because there's so many psychosomatic issues associated with trauma and the retention of trauma, which kind of refers to the, you know, vessel van der Kolk book, The Body Keeps a Score, which is, you know, because the body remembers everything.
Sure.
So there are 8 phases to EMDR. I'm now wishing Debbie was here with us, my co-author.
Aww.
So beautifully. But there are 8 phases to the therapy, but the one that people tend to hone in on is the one that has to do with the actual reprocessing of the memories themselves, of removing the charge from the memories themselves. And that is a function of what's called as, you know, bilateral stimulation.
Right.
So people who are listening and can't see me, I'm waving my hands back and forth, my hand in front of me, which is what my therapist did with me.
Yeah.
But people all use paddles that buzz right hand, left hand, or tapping. Prince Harry, he's talking, you know, telling the world now about his EMDR therapy experience and his traumatic experiences losing his mother. So there's lots of ways to use the bilateral stimulation, but that's what, that's the one of the eight phases of the therapy that's designed to reduce the level of anxiety and charge to these traumatic memories so that they can be processed into long-term memory and you can go on with your life, so that the stuff that's been held both in your body and your nervous system can come out up through you and out, and you're finally rid of it.
Wow. So you're
in many cases, those things are amplified because you're reprocessing terror that you experienced at two or at five or at three, not as an adult.
Right. So you're reliving that.
Correct.
And in the moment you're feeling this, is there a tempering from the therapist when you're working with that person saying, okay, calm down. Okay.
100%.
Right.
100%. Okay. You're, and this is in the book, your therapist's job is to keep you in what's referred to as a window of tolerance.
Right.
So you don't become overregulated or underregulated, you know, shutting down or getting, you know, too hyperactive.
Yes.
And that's their job, to keep you in that window of tolerance where you've got one foot in the present.
Right.
While the other foot is in the past. And you know, what Debbie talks about all the time is the process of redoing, because in that process, you're able to take that 2-year-old, 3-year-old traumatic experience and memory and recast it as an adult. So you can do things like, it wasn't my fault, or I was only 2 years old, or they never should have left me alone with that person in the first place. So you get to reframe the experience from an adult perspective.
That's beautiful. So when you come out of it and you're, are you reframing that when you're in the EMDR treatments?
Yes.
Or,
yes.
Okay, great. So that is really sort of covering over or congealing, reframing those old neural patterns that are saying,
exactly,
I'm not enough, right? I'm not lovable.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. To it wasn't my fault. I should have been better taken care of.
Right.
That person never should have been left alone with me, et cetera. It's, as you say, it's called neuroplasticity, where, you know, the neural pathways can actually reform to the old buried 2-year-old ones to the present day prism through looking back at the situation as an adult.
And, you know, the studies show that neuroplasticity is alive and well at all ages. You know, they always say, well, we really can't have decent neuroplasticity after the ages of 8, because that, you know, not true.
Yeah. Well, I didn't meet Dr. Magvita until I was 61.
Oh, wow. No, I don't believe that. That's amazing. How wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, that's beautiful. By the way, guys, in case you just tuned in here to The Couch, my special guest, Michael Baldwin, and the book that you, do you have a picture of the book you can hold up? I want folks to see how beautiful this is. Look at that. Every memory deserves respect. EMDR is the proven trauma therapy with the power to heal, right there. I love those pictures. Beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah,
and I love the pictures inside your book.
Yes. So for your listeners.
Yeah.
So the genesis of the book was, as I was learning about trauma and EMDR about 6 months along my 2-year experience with Dr. Magneta, I, as a visual thinker, because I was so scattered as a child, I couldn't read. I became a visual thinker. And I thought I would have these images surrounding concepts. And I thought, well, if I can capture these concepts with an image, a photograph, and very little bit of text opposite.
Right.
I create a thing called like a billboard. Now here's
one of them. Beautiful.
So traumatic experiences remain preserved in the brain and body, often unaltered from the moment they occurred. And that picture is of a man holding, that's actually the president of the Amber Society in Denmark, who I, the source of this photograph, of a little flower that's 35 million years old in that piece of amber that's perfectly preserved. Mm. So that gives anybody in any culture with any language a visual articulation of the concept that trauma gets frozen in your central nervous system, like that flower got frozen 35 million years ago, perfectly preserved. And the unfortunate aspect about the phenomenon, because it gets frozen because it's to survive.
Right.
But the unfortunate thing is, as adults, it becomes maladaptive, and it alters the way you see yourself, the way you see the world, and the choices you make. Right. So it's like a thorn in your side, or a thorn in your shoe that alters the way you walk, unless and until you remove it.
Is that true? You know, and what's so fascinating is, you mentioned as well, as we move along our lives, triggers come up, certain situations, triggers that may represent something that we can't quite put our fingers on, or our minds to.
Yeah. What, it could be a sound or a smell, or a voice. Yep.
Right. Any kind of sensory or visual situation. Yep. Someone reminds you of someone or something like that. And then and also, of course, we have assumptions. You know, when we are traumatized, we have, you know, unresolved fearful assumptions that we shove down and we're unaware of, but we're always kind of trying to understand relationships, right? Or work through, you know, you were talking about having, you know, nice relationships with a woman or a man or whatever those relationships were, working relationships. And it just didn't feel right many times. So we shove all that down because we're so confused and we don't understand what's going on. So
as I said before, why I could not go in and use a stall in a men's room, I had no idea. It was not even a possibility. Why I would, you know, go into, I remember I was going out with this woman, and we were away for a weekend and at a friend's house, and she was upstairs, I was downstairs. And at one point that one night, she came down to my room in a nightgown, and I blacked out. So that's the extremity of the panic-inducing reaction that I had no idea where it was coming from in me with when that situation presented itself. You know, so these things, the weird thing, as I said earlier, was I somehow just thought this is just the way I am, having no idea that reaction was directly connected to traumatic experiences that I had as a child.
And you just shut down.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, you know, don't understand too that, you know, there's so many different symptoms when you're having panic symptoms. But it's kind of rare, but I mean, it's real and a lot. You black out. You literally black out.
Yeah. And that was a trigger. I mean, for my case, because my abuse was threefold. So it was sexual abuse, physical abuse, and emotional abuse.
Right.
And, you know, it's funny how they've now determined that childhood neglect is even more damaging as in terms of complex PTSD than even childhood sexual abuse.
Isn't that something? I mean, it really is, you know, the whole abandonment or attachment theories that were formed, right?
Yeah. And it's funny, the best way I've come to understand the whole notion of attachment is that a healthy attachment is like a healthy immune system. Healthy immune system means that you don't die from a cold. Or, you know, half the stuff that goes around doesn't affect you because you have a healthy immune system. If you have an unhealthy attachment history, or in other words, you're not able to attach to any caregiver as a child, you're without bearings. You have no security, you have no foundation, you have no feel like you're just alone. And you enter adulthood with that complete absence of security and structure and knowledge that you have people who you can depend on and celebrate and protect and will take care of you.
Sure. And part of that also, the EMDR therapy is, I think there's a lot of, you know, they call it reparenting style, you know, in therapy, but you really are doing that. I mean, you're loving that little guy who's two, three, whatever years old, who is repeatedly, seemingly, abused and abandoned.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
And it can happen in any cultural, financial environment.
Socioeconomic.
Exactly.
And I think I think even clinicians make assumptions based on socioeconomic background that you're probably not, you know, you probably don't have a trauma history when that, you know, couldn't be further from the truth.
Right. You have a sense of entitlement. You grew up in wealth. You must be, you know, no. I mean, again, you know, it's looked like Prince Harry, Right? I mean, that's
Exactly.
really, really
Exactly.
amazing. People just assume, you know, but he's a real person and he has
Yeah.
stuff, so.
Yeah. Exactly.
You talk about big traumas and little traumas, and I think we touched a little bit on that as well. But they're all trauma. Can you share sort of the difference between the two?
Yeah, so I mean, I think most people associate trauma with what is referred to as big T trauma. As I said earlier, you served in combat, you survived a natural disaster, you were held up at gunpoint. But in reality, little T traumas like racism and being bullied, and anybody who's listening, who's ever dealt as a child with bullying, knows that you basically live in a state of complete terror. So in my case, my brother was a bully to me at home. I had a bully at school. And so you're never safe. You never, ever, you live in a state of terror. But things like, as an adult, again, things like, finding out that, there's an infidelity in a relationship, getting fired from a job, having a mortgage foreclosed on you, losing a loved one. All these things are all a part of life and they're all traumatic. But the key is, or I guess it differentiates, is that the trauma is not gauged by the event itself, is gauged by the impact it has on a specific individual. So if you have two people with an event, one person has had no attachment history, no attachment whatsoever, nothing, zero. The other person had very healthy attachment growing up. And let's say the event was losing a spouse or something. Well, one is going to be probably, way more severely impacted than the other who had a healthy, because they grew up with a sense of security and foundation and coping mechanisms that the other didn't have the luxury of having, and that's why, again, the importance of attachment.
Boy, is that true? I mean, it really is so important. And that we have these themes from the trauma, in our lives, like whatever they may be, I'm not lovable, or and
Yeah.
we're super sensitive, as we talked
Well,
about earlier.
it's a deduction that a child makes.
Yes, of course.
So, a pre-verbal child, this can be pre-verbal. Well,
Oh my
if I'm not
God.
being fed and no one's coming to take care of me, no one's changing my diaper, the pre-verbal child can deduce that, I guess I'm not worthy, I'm no good, I'm not lovable, I'm worth. That's what happens. As I said earlier, the reason why these things become so big is because the world is so small when you're 1 and 2 and 3 years old. So, and that when that gets locked away, the ampl it's the volume of it stays the same, even though you grow on to be an adult, and the impact it has remains the same. And again, as I said, it warps your view of the world, your view of yourself, and the choices you make. Like, why does Michelle have her sixth boyfriend who is physically abusive? It's because Michelle has probably some unresolved history having to do with abuse.
And it's comforting and or it
It's
seems normal
familiar.
and
We're unconsciously attracted to the
it's
familiar.
familiar. And I get that a lot, and I'm sure you've heard that a lot as well.
Yeah.
I mean, why do I keep, and I hear a lot of men and women, why do I keep ending up in these relationships where these women are drama queens and or narcissists?
Right, exactly. Why do
Because
I keep,
it's normal.
yeah, exactly. It's your
It's
normal.
familiar. It's
Exactly.
your normal, and all your friends are trying to figure out how to help you and say, well, what's up with that? But they don't understand
Yeah.
what you've been through
I
and
don't know
things
if you
like that.
saw, there was a New York Times piece a couple of days ago by David Brooks. It was a pretty long piece about a friend of his best friend for over 50 years, who committed suicide.
Oh my God,
Was
I didn't read that.
another childhood trauma and neglect survivor, and just he tried all kinds of things. But it's just another case of, here as an adult, successful, married, 3 children. That's the exterior. Interior, he shared with Dave Brooks that there was neglect and trauma in his childhood, probably unresolved, probably never was resolved, and unfortunately he committed suicide.
That is so sad. I'll read that. I'll have to read that.
It was
I
only a
like
couple
that.
days ago. It's
Yeah. Cool. I'll check it
David
out.
Brooks.
Okay. Yeah. So as you go on, let's say you're having the EMDR therapy and you're going on a treatment and you're becoming more and more aware and these things are coming out, are you experiencing physiological sensations that are uncomfortable for you?
I'll speak for myself. So for me, as I said earlier, in addition to the abuse, there was neglect, and it was on the part of both my parents. So starting at birth, pre-verbal, there was no one, feeding me regularly. There's no one taking care of me, so, and as an infant, you have no sense of time. And so is anyone ever coming? And when you're an infant and you're not being fed, your body cramps and things, it hurts.
My God.
And so I remember early on in Dr. Magnavita's office, like, why am I having this terrible cramping? What is going on right
My
now? It's
God.
like someone is in my controlling my body. And that is the somatic memory of the physiologic effect of neglect, not being fed, not, because I think, I don't know, I'm not a parent, but I think with infants, you have to, on a fairly regular basis, feed them. And if that's not happening, that's, it's hunger and then cramping. And
Oh my
so, in answer to
God.
your question, absolutely. And, Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps a Score, is all about the fact that
Right.
the body remembers everything. It's its own memory bank of trauma.
Yes. And a lot of people, poo-poo the idea of, well, I have achy body or I have this, or yes, this was exacerbated by an injury or a car accident I had or the, whatever I was having. Very interesting that these things come out in our body and our mind and body are so connected. And when
Yeah.
we really relive this and feel this and understand, and your specialist, your therapist, explained to you what was going on so you
Yeah.
understand this. So would you suggest to folks who are having particular pains and they're uncomfortable, and I'm not talking about people who've been examined and have had particular structural damage, let's say due to a car accident. Just, I don't know why I'm having these pains, or nobody can find out, right? Would you suggest
Yep.
people do that and try EMDR?
Absolutely. In fact, I would even be broader than that. I would say that, my advice to anyone who is suffering or knows and cares about someone who's suffering, friend, colleague, relative, neighbor, to raise your hand and seek out an EMDR therapist. And, the two words I often say is just don't wait. Because when I was in my 20s, Francine Shapiro, who discovered EMDR, wasn't it hadn't happened. That was until 1987. So I couldn't, I had no choice. Today, you can go to emdria.org, EMDRIA, that's the International Association for EMDR, and you can put in your zip code, and you can put in, I want a certified therapist, and you can even pick the insurance you have, if you have to use insurance, and you'll see certified therapists and then consultants in your area, in a few clicks of a mouse, and they're available to you. That is just a matter of figuring out who's the right one for you. But I would say absolutely don't wait. Life is too short, and EMDR is more about taking a car in, getting it fixed, and then driving away and living your life. I have friends, I'm up to 54 people who are asked for EMDR therapy recommendations from my co-author. 54 people, friends of friends, children of friends.
My God.
One had seen a talk therapist for 10 years and was getting nowhere, and has since switched to an EMDR therapist that Debbie recommended, and having just one revelation after another. So, I mean, who leaves their car at the repair shop for 10 years? Nobody. So
Exactly. No
why are
kidding.
you putting up with this talk therapy for 10 years? What are you doing? So I'm not, and I don't mean
I
demean
hear
talk
you.
therapy. I'm just saying that the orientation for EMDR therapy is efficacy and efficiency.
Yes,
And there's
exactly.
plenty of data and plenty of research
Oh, there
that
really
proves
is.
that out now.
There's a lot of research. And when it first came out back in 1987, 88, we were reading about it and going, ah, at first,
This sounds
how
crazy. Yeah.
snob community of, CBT is cognitive behavioral therapy and, all these other DBT and all these other methods, these are the ones that are really, you know, this is just what you're trained and to do and learn and everything. But I mean, this, when this came out, and then they started really doing the research on it, and this is one of the most effective that they found significantly in test after test, that this really helped people out, which blew me away. I mean, we were just all humbled, like, shut up. Shut up and learn how to do it.
Exactly. That's why with the World Health Organization, the Veterans Association, you know, the APA, you know, name it, it's pretty broadly accepted now. And we're, Debbie and I, you know, our mission is just to make people aware of it. If you go to a cocktail party in New York City, chances are half the people there have never heard of EMDR.
Right.
And I don't know how many of them might benefit from it, you know, themselves. But, you know, it's been around for 30 plus years. According to Debbie, it's the most effective and efficient therapy there is. I couldn't say enough of it as in terms of the impact it had in my life.
Yeah.
So we're just trying to get it out into the zeitgeist so people know about it and people understand the pervasiveness of trauma, and that there is a particular trauma-informed therapy called EMDR that is the most efficient and most effective.
Oh, beautiful. So, by the way, in case you just tuned in, folks, Michael Baldwin, my special guest, very successful gentleman, and he just wrote a book, Every Memory Deserves Respect. It's the proven trauma therapy with the power to heal. And of course, it's co-authored by Dr. Deborah Korn. She's PsyD, and she's a specialist as well in this particular type of therapy. You got to pick it up. It's a great, really great book. So it is supported by research. EMDR is one of, I was blown away about how much research has been.
Yeah.
You know, supportive on it, as opposed to so many other modalities or, you know, orientations of therapy.
And, you know, the other nice thing is there's a phenomenon in the New York Times bestseller list known as The Body Keeps a Score by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, who's the founder of the Trauma Institute in Boston. There's no book in the history of the New York Times bestseller list that's been on that list longer than this book. He's kind of the leading authority about of trauma in the world. He's a colleague of my co-authors, and he was kind enough to read our book, and he's the one who gave us a wonderful endorsement on the cover of the book.
Beautiful.
Which, of course, the publisher was delighted to have. But, I mean, that to me is another wonderful endorsement of what we're doing and what Debbie spent over 30 years doing, which is EMDR therapy.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And one of the myths is that it is only for adults, but that's not true, right?
Not true at all. I think Debbie has, I'm not sure Debbie treats children, but she talks about EMDR therapy for children. And again, there's an adolescence, and there's plenty of research now out on that also.
Yeah.
And also the effectiveness in terms of addiction and depression and anxiety and, you know, the usual suspects in terms of behavioral health symptoms, in addition to all the psychosomatic things, which, you know, irritable bowel system, back issues, muscular issues, gastric issues, all kinds of things that can, they get work their way into your physical life with that stem from trauma.
Right. Exactly. Wow. Talking about myths, another one is that we have to know exactly what our trauma is, and we must relive it in order to heal. And that's sort of, that's like old psychodynamic, you know, psychoanalytic therapy. It's like, feel the pain, let's relive it. But you can't really touch on that, right?
First of all, I think Debbie is great at this. Yeah. She always says that, I don't think she's ever had a patient come, well, maybe a few that said, I'm here to talk, you know, to see you about childhood trauma that I dealt with at age 3. It's more, I can't keep a job. I keep fighting with my wife. I can't seem to uphold a relationship. I can't stop drinking. You know, they come in, and Debbie's advice to everyone is just come to the door, bring you and your whole hot mess. Don't try to figure anything out.
Right.
Just bring it to the EMDR therapist, and they'll go, you'll go from there. I think that should be comforting to a lot of people who who only know about how bad they're feeling or how things in their life aren't going according to how they'd like them to go, and they don't know why.
Yes, exactly. They don't. I think, you know, I see this a lot. People come in and they just, why am I, like we discussed earlier, continually having these relationships that are abusive or negative, or why can't I find, or why, you know, why can't I get along with people at work? I think a lot of people also are misdiagnosed with personality disorders who are not functioning very well. Oh, that person's a narcissist or borderline, or that person is sort of unfair sometimes, I think, because you're labeling people. You know, of course, you have to find symptomology or behaviors in order to sort of put somebody in a box. But I don't know if that's really fair sometimes. I think you're just a person having stuff, and this is the way you're sort of functioning in the world through these defense mechanisms.
I don't know if you know Gabor Maté. He's kind of he's got a film out called The Wisdom of Trauma. Mm. And in that, very early on in that film, he says that in his opinion, 99% of the people who walk the earth are carrying some form of trauma, loss, or grief. Prince Harry now was recently on Stephen Colbert, repeated the same thing. He said he's convinced that in his view, 99% of people walking the earth are carrying around some form of trauma or loss or grief. So what does that say? That says that to the extent to which that trauma, loss, or grief is unresolved, it's going to affect and warp the way you see yourself, the way you see the world, and the choices you make. And so why not, I would say, would you rather have a spoon or a snowblower to clear your driveway? I'll take a snowblower.
Yeah, so, no kidding.
So why not take the most effective and efficient tool therapeutically than something else? Because, you know, life's just too short. And so we're just, you know, it's nice having Prince Harry as an advocate. I mean, I'm sure losing his mother wasn't the only trauma in his life. I'm sure there's lots.
Absolutely.
For everyone, you know, no one spared, pretty much.
Right, exactly. Just about Prince Harry, it's all of the, you know, documentaries you see, and you see this poor little soul walking with his brothers and his dad, and they are not supposed to speak. Their mother's coffin is, of course, they're being paraded around, and they have to quietly walk, and they can't show expression. And then after that, they're exposed to the trauma of people wanting to touch them and shake their hand. This little soul didn't have time to grieve. And
I'm not even sure in that environment.
Yeah, no.
That there was any room for any kind of, emotional intelligence or emotional honesty or anything. I think that was kind of not allowed.
No, right, exactly. And how many times have we in this culture, you know, as Americans, or if we're raised by certain types of parents, or, you know, old cultural, I don't know what they would be, but behavioral ways in front of other people is don't show your emotions. You're a young man. Usually it's put on the guys.
Yeah, and actually, I'm glad you made that point, because another main reason of wanting to create the book was, I think men are conditioned that sharing your story, revealing trauma in your life, seeking out help is something that is a sign of weakness and you shouldn't do. So I figured if I could share my story and my trauma history as a male, it might make other men more comfortable.
Absolutely.
You know, sharing theirs and seeking out someone who can help them resolve and help them heal.
God, that's beautiful. And I really appreciate you doing that, by the way, in your book. I mean, it really is. It feels good too. It's therapeutic writing it, I'm sure.
It's funny. I remember having to write my story for Debbie, and I was interviewed by my co-author as a clinician, because she's a clinician.
Sure.
And I remember when we were getting to all of the layers of grandiosity that I had manufactured to mitigate against this belief that I was worthless.
Sure, of course.
And it was just exhausting the extent that I went to. I mean, this status and achievement junkie and workaholism, and like, it was just, you know, getting into medical school, not going, running the Boston Marathon, but not walking a step.
Right.
Being the fastest promoted person in the history of the Irish Housing Agency I worked in after I decided not to go to medical school.
Right.
You know, getting my surname registered as a domain name before anyone else in the world ever had done it. I had a bet with a right. guy who invented Ethernet. So on and on and on and on and on and on to mitigate against this core belief that started when I was pre-verbal.
Right.
That I was unlovable and worthless. No
oh
good.
My God. You know, and so many people do. I mean, they're so successful, and people, like you said, they just judge, you know, they assume.
Yeah. And it's funny, you get to the point where you can see them a mile away.
Oh,
once you know, you can kind of see them a mile away. Like, it's so conspicuous. You know, what's behind this? And I think looking back at that person that I was, I look back with a sense of sort of shame and embarrassment. But what was I doing? I was delivering on a survival strategy that if I didn't put into place, it would have been curtains.
Right, exactly. And no, it's so true. And that goes with the whole philosophy of defocusing. How do we defocus on our inner pain? How do we what
Correct.
Do we do?
Exactly.
We go, you know, full out, you know, with our career or success, and we try to.
Yeah, and look at things, people, you know, Michael Jackson or Whitney Houston.
Oh, my
and you
God.
See, the thing is, there's one billboard I love, which is about not being able to escape the gravity of trauma. And meaning no amount of money, no status, no amount of anything, bottom line, can protect you.
No.
It's there, it's going to be there, and it's finally going to get its grip on you. And those, like the Michael Jackson or the Whitney Houston stories, are tragic examples of that, where you can't have more fame, you can't have more success, and still, you know, it's just... It ends up consuming them and with tragic consequences.
Right, exactly. And they're secretly having panic attacks when they get away from the public. They can't breathe. They're blacking out. They're, you know, that kind of thing. So, I mean, that's and stuff we don't know, stuff we don't hear about.
That's right.
You know, and you as an award-winning, you know, advertising guru for, 40 years or something, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You had no idea.
No, and you know, I even look back at that.
Yeah.
Again, I mentioned earlier, it took me 3 years to get into medical school. I don't go, and I go into advertising and sales. I look back on advertising as, this is just me. I don't want to, you know, offend any of your listeners, but I can think of so many better things to do with a life than advertising. And I'm so glad that this has become a focus in my life versus that.
Good for you. No, and it, you know, I'm into, it's all about giving and sharing. And that's really the stuff that's really important.
Yeah.
The heart, the brain, the mind, processing,
yep.
how you can best serve others as well.
Right. Exactly. Doing something.
Exactly.
Yeah, for other
and
people.
Love that which you are, not in a narcissistic sense.
Right.
But just say, good for you. You've done it. Yay. You got through this so far in your life and you're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
You know,
and you know, it's funny, this has been, it's been such a wonderful experience to get to know my co-author, to observe her, you know, the experience of writing the book with her.
Yes.
It was, you know, it's so much more work than you ever think it's going to be.
Yes.
We were fortunate to have a fantastic publisher in Wolfman Publishing. They were
that's
so
wonderful.
Great.
They really did a great job.
Yeah, they did. And you know, but, you know, it's kind of humbling because my co-author, you know, not only does she have her practice, but she does so much more in her life.
Yes.
She's also a mother and a wife to give back and to help, you know, in you know, with the veterans and with people who, you know, with the elderly and in her synagogue. And she's just an incredible example of humanity.
Oh, that's beautiful. And kudos to her and you for writing this book. Every memory deserves respect. EMDR, the proven trauma therapy with the power to heal. Check it out, folks. It's a wonderful read. And thank you for those beautiful pictures as well that you share, you know, that really have a lot of meaning to a lot of the points that you're bringing out in that. And I'm sure this will really help a lot more people with understanding how helpful EMDR can be and that you're not alone in your trauma. As a matter of fact, you're probably with the majority of people, as you said, in the world.
Yep.
So, Michael Baldwin, it's been a pleasure. It's about that time to wrap up, but thank you so much for being here. You've really helped a lot of people out there. I know you have.
Michelle, listen, thank you for having me. I wish Debbie could have joined us, but you're giving me a chance to be here just and reach your audience is a gift, and I'm really grateful.
Well, my pleasure having you. Thank you so much for all you do. All right. Bye-bye. All right. Thanks for joining me here on the couch. And as always, take good care of yourselves first, and then you'll be great for others. This is Dr. Michelle. Bye-bye.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.